Hogan, do you go to the movies these days still?
Sometimes it's rare, but you gotta have a big blockbuster to get me out.
Yeah, I haven't been to a movie in the theater and since I don't know when. Of course, I have a couple kids now, and that changes everything, but it's been a while.
Well, if there's a
But
big political blockbuster, I tend to go to the movies, though. I promise you that.
yeah, that's the thing. Our guest, I'm very excited about our guest this week, who is a fantastic filmmaker and has a new one coming out. To go with all the many books that he has written. And we'll get to that in a second. But this first is the Line Drive Podcast. So let's do that. Let's bring in the special guest, the great Dinesh D'Souza. Thank you so much, Dinesh, for being with us. We very much appreciate it.
Thanks, guys. Really happy to be with you and looking forward to this.
This is fantastic. I want to just set the stage here a little bit about the film, but then get to first, let's talk about Israel before we get to the movie. But I will preview it by saying, is this your seventh movie
You know, I
that
think it
you
is a seventh documentary. I did the first one on Obama and then most recently 2,000 Mules. And I'm very alarmed by what's happening in the country. That's why police state. And this, I think, in some ways is my most urgent and in some ways, I think also the best film.
They're always so timely too. I mean, this is something a lot of people are concerned about. And one of the things in the Trump administration that we just kind of thought was there and we knew it was happening, but now you see all of the emails and you see all the text messages and the phone conversations and the whistleblowers, and you start to realize exactly what these people have been doing to us for a long time. So I think this could not come at a better time, Dinesh.
Well, the normally a police state comes in with a lot of sirens because typically police states are established by some revolutionary overthrow of the government. Think of the Bolsheviks displacing the czars. And so everybody knows, okay, here it comes. But our police state is very cunning. It has been moving in very slyly. It is a police state that sprawls across the public and the private sector, and it marches behind the banner of law and democracy and striving for truth and fighting disinformation. So ours is a police state that pretends to be benign.
And that's probably the most treacherous kind, I would imagine. And speaking of treachery, before we get into the movie, I do want to talk about Israel and the attack on Israel by Hamas last weekend on Saturday. And Israel is now starting to respond. And Dinesh, I wanted to get your take on this. What as we all learned about this on Saturday, and we now see it playing out, and Israel going to take some retribution. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, in some ways, it's a bitter irony, isn't it? Because if we flash back to the aftermath of 9/11, a lot of Americans, I mean, me included, thought, okay, you know what? We need to give some additional police powers to our government because there's this dangerous force of radical Islamic terrorism abroad. And it is not done with us, and it's not done with our allies. And we need to find out everything that there is to know about it. And so this kind of surveillance is necessary. Now, little did we know that over time, these powers assigned to the government would be perversely twisted and repositioned and aimed at citizens in the United States, and not to mention going after political opponents and so on. So this is the way in which these powers have been abused. But if you think about the original grant of powers to the government, it was to strengthen our intelligence agencies so that they would foresee something like this. And yet, I think I saw on social media, was it Jake Sullivan, who said, the Middle East has been the quietest that it's been in decades. So obviously, this dude had no idea that this was coming. And that's a massive failure, not just of Israeli intelligence, but of our own.
It is. How much of this, let's talk about the intelligence community is one thing in theory, separate from the administration. But here you have Biden, and he didn't invent this style of policy, but you have Biden, who is clearly in the appeasement mode for Iran, which of course is the chief state sponsor of terrorism around the world, unfreezing their $6 billion as part of that prisoner swap. And while that is too recent for that money to have been used in this current attack, it certainly frees up money that they have on hand because now they can count on $6 billion. But it also is a pattern when he was vice president, the pallets of cash, everybody remembers that, and just the leniency and treating of terrorist states. The idea is that if you treat terrorists very nicely, suddenly one day they will, what, stop being terrorists? I mean, how much of this is laid at Joe Biden's feet or at the feet of, you know, pointy-headed liberal academic types who make American foreign policy these days?
Well, I mean, the remarkable thing about our emerging police state, which I'm, if I can use that term, is it's a police state that is opaque at the top. We're not totally sure who's running it, right? And this is unusual because normally in a police state, oh, it's Stalin. Oh, it's, you know, it's in China, Xi Jinping. To the degree that Russia is a quasi police state, it's Putin. In Castro, of course, it was Cuba. It was in Cuba, it was, of course, Castro. Maduro in Venezuela. But in our police state, there is somebody calling the shots, and I'm not saying that Biden is just sitting idly in the canoe. I think that he is an accessory. He's going along. He's reading the script, but it's quite clear that he's not making all these major decisions. In fact, I think I read that they didn't wake him up until 8 a.m. Although the Hamas attack, had occurred at around midnight. Other people were told, and other people, in effect, were being the president while Biden was getting in one of his lengthy naps.
Wow. That I had not heard that. That's remarkable. They didn't. So it was 8 a.m. before Biden, before the president of the United States knew that this was happening. That's astounding.
It's unreal. Dinesh, do you have any friends or family over there that are in serious trouble or missing or anything like that?
No, I mean, Debbie and I were in Israel, actually our first visit last December. And we were just so taken by Israel, partly because of the historical significance, partly the biblical significance. I mean, the Old Testament and the New. We were sort of looking at a lot of the magnificent archaeological discoveries there. Sure. A lot of the ancient Hebrew prophets and kings who for centuries were thought by many people to be mythological. Who knows if there really was a Jeremiah? Well, wow, now it turns out there really was a King David and there really was a King Solomon and there really were these guys. And so it's like, wow. And I think the relevance of all that to what's going on here is that ultimately you see the preposterousness of the claim, not just by Hamas, but many people in the Muslim world, that somehow the Israelis are colonizers. No, they're not colonizers. This was their land. And in the 7th century, a new force, a conquering force called Islam, came upon the world. It swept across the Middle East, conquering Christian lands, Syria, Jordan, then sweeping across Jerusalem. So if anybody could be called a colonizer, it would be ultimately the armies of Muhammad.
Yeah. All right. I know we're going to go to the movie here, Tim, but I just have one quick question. Do you have a dog in the fight for the Speaker of the House? I know that Scalise won the vote today. Jordan's up there, too. Any thoughts on that before we pivot to your movie?
I mean, I would just offer this thought. I found over the several decades now that I've been observing carefully and participating in American politics, that the Republican leaders who tend to be the most effective, and Reagan is a classic example of this, are philosophically grounded and strong, but temperamentally genial, so that they're able to bring a pretty wide coalition. They're trusted. They're good for their handshake and their word. And so even the so-called moderates will make deals with them because they recognize that this guy is somebody that is basically a straight shooter. The problem for Republicans is when you get the opposite, somebody who is philosophically unsteady, but then temperamentally fanatical. And that's the worst combination of all, because then you get somebody you can't trust, but nevertheless, they come across as extreme. So you get all the worst impact of that. So for these reasons, I mean, I don't want to sort of take sides. By and large, in our films, we try to unify our side against the threats coming from the other side. Right. So I don't get into the horse race, who's up and who's down, but I don't mind defining sort of the features that I think make for a good leader.
Yeah. That's all right. Fair enough. That makes sense to me. Let's talk about your movie, Police State. And by my count, I guess you weren't keeping track, but my count, starting with the Obama movie, this makes number 7 with this, and it's not out yet. Let's go through some of the particulars here. You're having explain how this works. You're having a theater premiere, a two-night premiere on October 23rd and 25th, and then a virtual premiere on October 27th. How does that all work?
So we had to reinvent the model for distributing movies after COVID and the theatrical shutdowns. The old system really didn't work. And so what we do now, which is a little bit wild, is we buy out hundreds of theaters. We buy every seat. And then what we do is we put those seats up on our website. So you can go on the website, which is policestatefilm.net. You plug in your zip code and boom, all the theaters around you pop right up. And you can buy one ticket, you can buy 10, you can buy 50. You don't have to buy at the theater. You just go with as many friends or a group from your church or a bunch of right-wingers or Republicans. You go together. I make these movies for the theater. So I always emphasize the theatrical experience. So if you can see it in the theater with other people who are like-minded, it's going to get you really fired up and really talking. But if you can't do that, or some people will say, well, you know, theater is 40 minutes away. I don't live in the city. And then I go, okay. Well, in that case, wait for the virtual premiere, which is Friday, October 27. And we do it out of this magnificent studio out of Las Vegas. We have live music. We play the whole movie, live Q&A with me and Dan Bongino to follow. The audience can participate. So it's a very unique way to see the movie if you want to watch it at home. And then after that, it'll be available for streaming. There'll be DVDs. So there'll be a number of different ways to watch the movie. But we're encouraging people right now to go to the theater or sign up for the virtual premiere. And you can only do that at the website, which is policestatefilm.net.
I have your, can I play part of the trailer? I would assume you would not object to that, right?
Go for it.
All right. So you're talking about this is going to get people fired up. I've watched this trailer a couple times and just the trailer, I think it does the trick. So yeah. I hope this works technologically and I think it will come across for the audio listeners of the podcast as well, even though it's a movie trailer.
Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans represent an extremism that threatens the very foundations of our republic.
Chief Division Counsel and DOJ have approved a no-knock breach.
We want the subject to be on display, doing the walk of shame, full visual impact. Any questions?
Are we becoming a police state?
Government told American citizens they couldn't go to church on Sunday.
I've never seen anything like it. It may be the Russia other people grew up in, but not my America.
FBI warrant, come to the door now!
There's a heavy banging at my door. Open up! It's 15 marked units on my property. I got SWAT in the back of my house.
It took a battering ram to my door.
6 a.m. I hear boom, boom, boom.
And here about 6 to 8 military style soldiers,
with the tallest one of them pointing an automatic rifle at my head.
FBI.
All right, that I think that gets the flavor of it. But man, oh man, that so it's in conjunction with Dan Bongino, of course. And let me read the beginning of the film blurb that Patricia provided me from your office. Is the United States becoming a police state? Incredibly, the answer is yes, and both sides of the political aisle disagree. Or I'm sorry, both sides of the political aisle agree. The only difference is that each side accuses the other of seeking to establish a police state. Who is right? So Dinesh, tell us the story of the movie. What sort of picture does it paint?
Well, it's a movie that couldn't be made 5 years ago, because if I went around saying I'm making a movie called Police State, people will think I was making a movie about North Korea or some other country. We are so accustomed to thinking of the United States as a free society where we have basic unalienable rights that are not even up for majority negotiation or majority overrule. It doesn't matter if 95% of people disagree with me, they can't cancel out my right to free speech or my right to conscience. So there it is in the Bill of Rights, equal justice under the law, all of it. And yet, we suddenly look around and realize that every single one of these basic rights is now in jeopardy. And if you look at the features of police states around the world, things like mass surveillance, censorship, police states tend to be one-party states where it doesn't mean they don't have elections. I mean, China has elections, Iran has elections, but the elections are conducted in such a way that the opposition is subordinate to the ruling regime. So the elections are kind of a charade. And then you have criminalization of political differences. You have targeting of dissenters. You have political prisoners. And I say, wow, all these features, classic features of police states, things right out of Orwell and the Gulag Archipelago, are now observable in the United States. So I'm not saying we're a full-fledged police state, but I think it is really remarkable how rapidly we have moved in that direction.
Why did you, like, look, I know it's a big problem. I think people have recognized that now, and I'm excited to watch this entire film so that I can see you put the exclamation point, the finer point, on exactly kind of what we all knew to be the case for so long. But why did you feel moved to make this particular film? You've made so many others that have been such massive hits that have exposed so many different aspects of our life to truth and reality. Why this movie and why now?
Well, I think the movie captures, in a sense, the exhilaration of when I first came to America and I found myself in a society with a lot of opportunity, a lot of upward mobility. But then I also realized that being an American is having these basic rights. And there they are listed in the Bill of Rights, which is not an exhaustive compendium, but it's a pretty good indication of what our rights are. And then I said that I'm seeing little by little an encroachment on these rights to such a degree that I'm not even sure now that I can with a straight face say that we are today in the United States a free society. And I also began to see that many of these same police state techniques are emerging in Canada, in Australia, in Europe, in New Zealand. And so I said to myself, we might even be dealing with something bigger than a police state. I'm going to call it a police planet. Now, the pretexts for the abridgment of rights varies. It could be COVID. That's why we're going to take away your right to assemble and go to church. And then it could be January 6th. And that's why we're going to expand censorship across digital platforms and ban certain people for life. So under various pretexts, but nevertheless, the movement is all in the same direction. And the other scary thing about it is not just the government. You think of censorship. If it was just the government, you'd say, all right, let's vote the government out and the problem would be solved. But when you have censorship that involves academia, the media, the nonprofit sector, many agencies of government, and the digital platforms. I mean, think about it. You have academics will make lists and go, yeah, Hogan Gidley and Dinesh D'Souza need to be banned. And then that gets picked up by the Biden regime. And then you get put on a list for the CDC. I get put on a list for election fraud debate. So I'm now on the CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Agency list. And then the government is they don't want to be caught red-handed directly banning anybody. So they use a middleman. They hand over the list to the Stanford Internet Observatory or the Virality Project. And they go, hey, listen, you guys turn over the list to the digital platform so they can ban these guys. And then the media will cheer. So, I mean, look at this complicated organism, this octopus stretching across the private and the public sector both. So what the film does is it kind of exposes the mechanics of the police state. Lots of whistleblowers and informants in the film, and also lots of ordinary guys who can feel, to use Orwell's term, the boot stamping on their face, which is the essence of a police state.
Yeah, and I, such a tough knot to unravel, too, because you have, like in the case of, you're talking about there, the example that you used of the using a middleman to actually perform the censorship. The Biden White House was very open about having talked to Facebook. Jen Psaki said it from the podium one day. Yeah, right. Sure. We flag these things for Facebook and then Facebook goes and takes whatever action they decide to take. But now we know from the Twitter files that there was incredible pressure put on by the Biden White House on these social media companies to do exactly what the government wanted them to do. And then here you have the media sort of playing goalie. When you think that the media would be up in arms about such an obvious First Amendment violation, but they're playing goalie saying, well, you know, Twitter is still a private company and no one was actually instructed on what to do and they're not answerable to the government, so on and so forth, making all the excuses. So how do you, I know you make a movie about it and describing the problem, but in practical terms, how do you cut through that knot? How do you fix it? Because these people are not, as you point out, they're not answerable by election. A lot of them.
Ultimately, they have to be challenged and exposed and fought at many different levels. And so this is not going to be corrected overnight. I think we should think of it almost like we used to think about the Soviet Union in the 80s, and that is in terms of rollback. So rollback is we're not going to get the whole thing to collapse in one shot, although in the end it did. But we're trying to run the Soviets out of Afghanistan, and we're going to try to get them to pull back from Eastern Europe, or we're going to try to liberate the, you know, Czechoslovakia and the Baltics and so on. And so similarly here with the police state, we're not going to be able to crush it in one shot. But we do have powerful institutions on our side. We have the Supreme Court. We've got, of course, the Republican House. There are plenty of Republican governors and attorneys general and secretaries of state. We are starting to build our own rival institutions. I think the biggest problem, I would say, is psychological. And that is that there's just a real difference of intensity between the typical leftist and the typical conservative. The typical conservative is much more likely to say something like, well, if the other side goes gangster on me, I'm not going to go gangster on them because I'm a man of principle. I am too good for that. So I'm going to be above all that. This is sort of something you get out of, like, say, Mike Pence every day. But then you also begin to realize how Mike Pence would be essentially, you know, cannon fodder for the left because they love people who are going to, in a weak-kneed sense, not retaliate in kind, even when the situation in the country becomes really dangerous. I mean, it's one thing in a safe community to say, all right, listen, you know, I'm not going to go for my rifle because we have the cops and we have law and order. You can be like Jimmy Stewart and the man who shot Liberty Valance. But then when you go out in a covered wagon and the outlaws encircle your ranch and they're going to burn your homestead, rape your wife, kill your kids, then if you say, I'm not going to go get my gun because I don't want to be just like the gangsters, Dinesh, you know, I'm too good for that. I'm going to stand on principle. Then you're beginning to border on absolute insanity. And so part of what my movie is aimed at doing is stiffening the spine of Republicans and conservatives to recognize we are actually in a pretty dangerous situation and politics as usual is not going to be good enough.
So two things coming off that. One is, do you think sooner or later they're going to grasp that concept that we're in a pretty big struggle here? And then the second thing is, what surprised you from the stories you heard while you were making this movie?
Well, one of the things that I think is surprised me, well, didn't surprise me entirely, but it was almost sad to see, is so many of the guys who are entrapped by the police state. And there's an element of entrapment for sure. They trust the government. They trust the police agencies of the government. These are back the blue type of guys. So when the FBI comes and knocks on your door and they say, we want you to sit down for a long interview, you know, it doesn't matter if you're Michael Flynn or it doesn't matter if you're a January 6th protester or some mom who's gone to a school board meeting, they always go, let's sit down and have a chat. Not realizing that the FBI is looking at an accordion book of federal laws. And even if you haven't done anything, there are many different ways that they can get you. They'll interview you for 7 hours. They'll find out that two statements that you made contradicted each other. Then they go, well, both can't be true because you said this happened on Wednesday. And then later you said it happened on Thursday. So one of them is clearly a lie. Lying to a federal officer is a felony. It's a serious crime. So people don't realize how vulnerable they are when they succumb to the system, but they do so with this kind of American innocence that, by the way, goes all the way back to Mark Twain, Huckleberry Finn. Gee, I haven't done anything wrong. I pay my taxes. I'm a good American. They don't realize that, no, you are in somebody's crosshairs and you need to be very careful.
Yeah, so they're creating, we've seen it happen many times, they create process crimes by getting people involved in questioning. And they're what they're doing, and I think you described it, they're preying on a lot of Americans' inherent trust of law enforcement, right? Especially conservatives for the longest, really respect and revere law enforcement for the jobs that they do, especially as compared to the way that the left views them. And law enforcement, I think at times, the FBI, for example, they know that. And they prey on the people and become victims of it. A lot of times the left will sort of just scoff at talk about the deep state, and I'm sure as we're talking about your movie called The Police State, I'm sure you're going to get a few brickbats hurled your way from the left. But when, to me, when people talk about the deep state, it's these are more people who you can't reach through elections. It's people who are entrenched in the federal government, who either enact policies that are not the policies of the current administration, or they thwart, they use their roles in the federal government to thwart policies of the elected administration. So, I mean, is that part of the movie, or because in the trailer, it's the more shocking stuff. It's the no-knock warrants and the FBI comes slamming right through the door. But, you know, one can be just as bad as the other.
Yeah. I mean, in the movie, I like, and I try to do this with all my movies. I mean, I try to go so far beyond where people are right now that I will try to come up with answers for things that people didn't even know were questions. And so, for example, I'll mention two things briefly. One is police states typically have walls. Think of the Berlin Wall. In a police state, normally you can't get in and you can't get out. They lock you in. It's a prison. The whole country is a prison. Now, we have a police state, or an emerging police state, with an open border. So my first question is, that's odd. That's interesting, because it makes our police state sort of unique. We don't care who leaves. We don't apparently care who comes in. Now, why would an open border make sense for our emerging police state? So that's a question we take seriously. I've never seen this question ever publicly discussed anywhere, but it's discussed in the movie. A second question that intrigued me in this movie was this, and it's related to what you said about the bureaucracy. How do you get basically decent people to do horrible things? How do you get an FBI guy, who let's presume is not a bad guy? This guy may have a military background. He's got a family. He lives in a three-bedroom house. But you want him to go into an apartment and grab like a 70-year-old grandmother and like pull her down to the ground, twist her arms behind her back, put her in handcuffs if she will resist, pull her down the stairs, pull her into the street where her neighbors will come and gawk. So you're acting like a monster, but you're not a monster. So how does a police state recruit a decent fellow to do this? And I think this requires really thinking about how bureaucracies work, because the way bureaucracies work is they always operationalize what you're doing. I remember, I'll explain this way. I was watching a documentary, an interview with the guy who was the FBI kind of hostage guy at Waco. This is basically a sniper. You bring him in when negotiations fail. His job is to sort of take the guy out, take out David Koresh. And he was asked, you know, did you know who David Koresh was? Did you know about Waco? And he goes, no. He goes, I never know. He goes, I am called in and the government points to a person and goes, that's a bad guy, kill him. And he goes, what I do is I just figure out how I do that. I line myself up. So the way this guy thought of it is he thought of himself, I'm a fighter for truth and justice in the American way. It's not my job to determine who's right and who's wrong. That's somebody else's job. When they bring me in, I define my job narrowly, which is, can I operationally carry this out? If I do, I'm successful. I get a bonus. I get a promotion. So what's interesting, I think, is that in the bureaucracies of the police state, the DHS, the FBI, they have set up these parameters and goals. So the ordinary FBI agent thinks, well, you know, if I'm working on child trafficking, that's seen as kind of uncool in the FBI. But if I'm working on January 6th, this is like hot. This is a big deal. This is how I'm going to get my $30,000 bonus. This is how I'm going to be promoted. This is how I'm going to be seen as somebody who's like in with the FBI. So these very human motives, bureaucratic motives come into play. And yet, if you step back and look at it, this is how you get basically decent guys to do some really bad stuff.
It's like, and that's such a great point, Dinesh. Again, I can't wait to watch this, but it's like if you're a reporter and you cover the White House and you're a jackass, and being a jackass makes you get promoted to be the chief White House correspondent.
Dinesh, he talks about Jim Acosta all the time.
I'm not talking about Jim Acosta. Just slow down.
Okay.
I'm just saying what it does is it sends a signal to everyone underneath them that that's the way you get promoted. That's the way you move up. That's the blueprint. That's the model. And so what I hear you saying is inside these three-letter agencies, you have people, and while they're not really supposed to be political at all, they're supposed to follow the law and do all the truth, justice, the American way. When you're asked to play ball and you don't, then you're passed over for certain things. You're not looked at a certain way. And I talked to Nicole Parker, an FBI agent for a a long time, 12 years in the Miami field office. I work with her over at America First Policy Institute. And she was saying, you'd be shocked at the jockeying that goes on. I was like, no, I wouldn't, because I'm in politics. But in an agency like that, how prevalent is it just the upper echelon? Is it all the way down to the lowly, janitor type person, or, you know, in our society, whatever, who's really, you know, pulling the strings? Who's at fault here inside that massive behemoth of a structure?
Well, very often, I think the corruption does have to come from the top. But what they do very cleverly is they create a system of signals that goes all the way to the bottom. And by the way, this is not unique to government. It also is true in the private sector. It's true in corporate America. It's true in the media. Let me give you a totally different example, but it's a police state example, and it clarifies the point. Think about the suppression of the Hunter Biden story. Now, you've got hundreds of news organizations, thousands of journalists all over the country, right? And so then I ask you, how is it possible to have people who are not openly conspiring? I mean, you and I know people don't, all these news organizations don't have like a 6 a.m. Zoom call where they all say, listen, well, let's just all suppress the Hunter Biden story. They don't conspire that way. And yet it's almost as if they did, because their actions show. And you would think, again, you know, if you're a libertarian, you think, well, we live in a free market. There's going to be some enterprising journalist, surely, at the Sacramento Bee or the Dallas Morning News. And that guy's going to be like, oh, you know what? If these idiots don't want to cover the Hunter Biden story, that's fantastic, because it leaves the whole story for me. I'm going to get the story. It's going to be the biggest story of the year. But no one does it. No one breaks the code. No one steps forward and goes, I'm going to do it. Why? It's got to be. There's only one explanation. It's got to be that there is such a powerful signal throughout the journalistic community that if you step out and do this, the sword of Damocles will fall on your head in such a way that you will never get up again career-wise. And so even the lowliest reporter gets the message and goes, you know what? I'm not going to go there, because I don't want that sword to chop off my head.
That is, you are describing something right. that Hogan and I lived through at the end of the 2020 Trump campaign. And every time this comes up, I can't even stand it. I get so mad. But you're right. You're describing the widespread suppression of the Hunter Biden story by the entirety of the news media, save the New York Post and Fox. And they were all looking for a reason not to cover it. And here comes the deep state, 51 former intelligence officials signing this bogus letter saying, sure looks like Russian disinformation to me. And that gave them everything that they were looking for. Thank God, something we can cling to. And here's a real reason why we're not going to cover the story. Previously, they were just looking around for reasons not to cover it. Oh, maybe it was hacked materials and all that stuff. And you see it, actually, they're being punished now. And I know that it was because they didn't want to, no one ever wanted to step forward, like you said, because it's to break the code. It's the, no one wants to get kicked out of the cool kids club. And just today in the White House briefing, Stephen Nelson from the New York Post was complaining to Corinne Jean-Pierre about being ostracized, and she hasn't taken his questions since May. And it's, you know, one of the largest newspapers in the country, the oldest newspaper in the country. And she refuses to call on him in the briefings. And it's clearly retribution for the New York Post breaking the Hunter Biden laptop story, and the Biden White House is not going to talk to them. And they do it in public, and the rest of the media just sits there and says, yes, they're punishing the bad boy. I'm glad it's not me.
Yeah, I think in terms of trying to understand what's going on, we have to get beyond what I would call double standard analysis.
Yes.
And by that, I mean, we think we have scored a massive point by saying, hey, look at this police state. It's going after Trump, but it's not going after Biden. It's actually protecting him. It went after the January 6th defendants, but on the other hand, it seems to give a much lighter touch to BLM and Antifa. And we think that by exposing this double standard, we have scored a major point. But here's the problem. The problem is that is all based on the hidden assumption that the police state operates according to a rule of equal rights under the law. If they did, you have now caught them in a massive contradiction, and you would expect them to be completely ashamed. But they're never ashamed, because in fact, the premise is false. The police state never operates on that assumption. The police state's assumption is different. It is that we will ruthlessly protect everyone who is helping to build the police state, and we will energetically go after everyone who poses a threat to the police state. And that is our consistent position. There's no double standard. We will help those who are helping us, and we will undermine those who are a threat to us. And when you apply the single standard, you suddenly realize everything makes sense. This explains why the government is acting one way over here and a different way over there. They see the Biden regime as the custodian of the police state. It's giving these agencies unlimited power. It's not holding them accountable. Basically, the Democrats are covering up the crimes of the FBI. So guess what? The FBI will then cover up the crimes of the Democrats. It's right. Like a reciprocal arrangement.
Yeah, and none of those 51 who signed that letter, the Hunter Biden, the Russian disinformation letter, not one of them has paid a price. You got guys like Brennan and Clapper who are still on CNN every day serving as analysts, even though they lied to the country brazenly about that and many other things. And no one has paid a price. And the guy who put it all together is now the Secretary of State.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
Either the 51 agents have no idea how to really spot Russian disinformation, which is a problem in and of itself, or they can, and they just lied about it. Either way, it's not good. But you talked about kind of the excuse of the police state and the different apparatchiks that kind of work to protect it. What's the media's excuse? Because we touched on this a little bit, Dinesh, but, you know, I was a journalist way back in like the late 90s, early 2000s. If you had told me there was grainy video of a Pfizer official, you know, saying, hey, these drugs really don't work, or there was this laptop of a son of a president who had all these pictures, sure, but it was about, you know, massive amounts of money coming into the Biden family, or, you know, whatever is we're learning kind of in these little pockets. I'd have jumped all over that. I would have thought this is the biggest story. Like you said, one journalist is out there going, man, this is going to be great. But why would they want to, when did the left become protectors of three-letter agencies and big pharma? It's so weird and kind of on its head. Why do they, it's not just for, I know you talked about it a little bit, but why are they protectors of the police state too? It's just weird you think they'd be standing up for people's rights.
Yeah, so I think the answer must be that in a lot of these institutions, and the media is only one of them, you could ask this exact same question about, let's say, the CDC. You'd be like, wait a minute, why doesn't the health authority, which, by the way, all of us trusted before COVID, see somebody in a white lab coat and they say, here's a pill, you don't know what's in it, but take it. We obviously give me a glass of water. You know, I'm ready to do it. I need a vaccine. Okay, go for it. So what I'm getting at is you've got the FBI was a trusted institution, the CDC, so many of these agencies, and you discover that what's really happened is there's been a sort of ideological infiltration in a way that is very shocking, because in a way, I'm not so surprised it occurs in academia. I'm not even so surprised it occurs in the media, but I'm really surprised to see it in the Defense Department and in the FBI. And in the National Institutes of Health, I mean, that's where you think you have people coming out of medical school. They're going to want to subject every drug to rigorous testing. They're not going to do brazen lies. And if you get a, you know, a phone call from Fauci, he goes, listen, I need you to change your view and say that this did not come from a lab. This was act. And I go, okay, that's fine. I'll do that, even though I'm one of the leading virologists in the world. So the way that these a combination of not just ideological, but financial incentives. In the case of the virologist, there was a lot of, these are people who have gotten a lot of federal money, and there's a lot more to come if they play ball. And so the police state uses very mundane human motives to achieve ends that are in the end so nefarious.
Hmm. We're talking about Dinesh D'Souza's new film, Police State. And again, as I said, we want to be respectful of your time, and we thank you so much for coming on with us. I want to describe it again. It's called Police State. The website is policestatefilm.net. Do I have that right?
Yes, you do. That's it. Policestatefilm.net.
Two-night premiere coming up later this month, October 23rd and October 25th in theaters. And then the virtual premiere on October 27th. And if you could give us, you know, the 60 second rundown of what people should be expecting to learn when they watch this film.
It's also scary because it's Halloween. This is like one of the scariest things that's coming, Dinesh. Like this could not be a better time movie. I'm telling you, I'm really excited.
Yeah, it's gonna be great.
I mean, the movie is full of informants, and it's full of whistleblowers and people who take you into the evil sausage making of the police state. Because a lot of times people make generic comments that don't really make any sense. Even the term deep state is not really quite right, it seems to me. Why? Because it implies the whole thing is hidden. Well, some of it is hidden. But guess what? If you go to YouTube and just read the guidelines, they will tell you 17 topics that will get you banned. That part of it is right there in the open. It's not deep. It's out there, right in front of you. You know, so a film can do things that a conversation, a book, an op-ed can't do. And that is, it can emotionally, intellectually, experientially draw you into the police state. And it's an unforgettable experience, in some ways almost incommunicable. I mean, if you went to see, let's just say, The Shawshank Redemption, and you're trying to describe it to someone who hasn't seen it, it's very hard to do because the movie itself is a sort of transforming experience. So I try to make movies at that level. In other words, where people come out and they're like, I understand this, but not just in the sense that I can think about it. I've sort of been there, and I now know what that feels like, because that's really what gets somebody, you know, it gets their conviction to be fired up. And that's my goal. I make movies that are ultimately emotional narratives. And this one, I think, stands in a class of its own. So I'm really excited about it. And I urge people to see it and see it in the theater if you can. But if you can't, no problem. Watch it at home, and it's just as powerful there.
It's great. It's going to be a success.
Yeah, I hope it's a big success. And I learned, I assume this is right, because I always trust Wikipedia, don't you guys? Your first movie, which was called The Roots of Obama's Rage, is it still the highest grossing conservative documentary of all time? Is that true? Is that
still right. True? So the film that came out that accompanied that book was called 2016 Obama's America.
Roots of Obama's Rage
was the book, and then 2016 was the film. So out of political documentaries, the most successful is Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, which is number one, and then 2016 Obama's America is number two. So I think in the top 10, I've got like number two, number six, and number eight. So I'm giving Michael Moore a run for his money, which...
Good.
Shouldn't be that hard to do. I think I'm
fantastic.
A filmmaker than he is.
You're like in a lot of years how the SEC has multiple teams in the top 10, right?
That's exactly right. So, SECs of documentarians. Very good.
That's exactly right. So Dinesh D'Souza, thank you very much for your time. Once more, it is called Police State. It comes out in theaters on October 23rd and October 25th in a theater near you. Virtual premiere online on October 27th at policestatefilm.net. Dinesh, we really, really appreciate your time. Thanks for being with us. And
thank you.
Thank you. And Hogan, good to see you. And thank you. And this has been the Line Drive Podcast.